TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness. Is nuclear power coming back? In domestic and foreign policy, in legislation and funding priorities, the Bush administration has made a major shift towards building new nuclear power plants and nuclear fuel reprocessing sites. Technologies that were abandoned in the U.S. decades ago. The energy bill, passed in the fall of 2005, set aside $8.7 billion for the nuclear, oil, and coal industries, while offering only $1.3 billion for alternative car fuels. Some have asked why the oil industry, with record high profits, needs a $1.6 billion subsidy. Not enough critics have investigated the biggest line item of them all, the unprecedented $4.3 billion to the nuclear industry. The anti-nuclear campaigner Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, invited scientists, members of the administration, and journalists for a two-day conference to address these issues. What is the connection of nuclear power and war? The safety record of nuclear power plants and their effect on the people living around them? And what lies behind the claim of the Bush administration that nuclear power plants are being brought back to ward off global warming? You are about to hear the keynote address by Representative Ed Markey from Massachusetts. He was first elected to Congress in 1976 and has fought against nuclear proliferation and for environmental protection. As you will see, Ed Markey and Helen Caldicott are friends and have worked together on the nuclear freeze and in the aftermath of the 1979 accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. Here is Ed Markey.
I would not miss an event that Helen asked me to appear at, especially one that is as important as this one is. In 1980, on the first anniversary of Three Mile Island, Helen and I were the anti-nuclear pair, and Norman Rasmussen, and I can't remember who the other person was, were the pro-nuclear pair in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in the state capitol before 3,000 people on the first one-hour McNeil Lehr news hour. And it was live in front of 3,000 people. And it was an incredible debate that reached kind of this climactic point where Rasmussen leans into me and he says, "Congressman, you are not an expert on nuclear power. You don't know what you're talking about." And I said, "Professor, I don't think you understand. The people don't trust the experts anymore." And with that, 3,000 people started applauding for 5 minutes. And Jim Lehr was looking over at me like, "Don't do that again. Don't do that again. We'll never have another guest audience. This is it. Okay, this is the only time we'll ever have one." You can almost see it in his eye. This is not meant to be participatory here, you know? But that was the beginning of the end of nuclear power here inside of the United States. The people were speaking. The people didn't trust the experts anymore. And so within another year or so, Helen and I and Randy Forsberg and Randy Keeler would kind of introduce the nuclear freeze resolution into the House of Representatives, and I asked Senator Kennedy to introduce it in the Senate. And then we were off and running on this linkage between nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and nuclear proliferation. That is the use by countries around the world of nuclear power as a cover for their nuclear weapons program. So the subject today, nuclear power and global warming, is without question a subject that people who are skeptics about nuclear power have to answer. So let me just begin by saying that there are a number of problems. Number one would be the nuclear waste problem. I was in the room in 1987 when Yucca Mountain was selected. And I can tell you that it didn't go to Hanford Reservation in Washington State because Tom Foley didn't want it to go there. It didn't go to Texas because Jim Wright didn't want it there. It didn't go to Louisiana and the salt domes down there because Bennett Johnson didn't want it there. It didn't go to Mississippi because Trent Lott didn't want it there. It didn't go to New Hampshire, although it's called the Granite State, because John Sununu was the governor, and John Sununu was making it quite clear that his support for George Bush as the nominee in 1988 would kind of be tied to whether or not New Hampshire was taken off the list. So what happened on our committee was we selected, I didn't select, I said this is a foolish process, we should have the National Academy of Sciences selecting the best location. Our committee selected Nevada. Now what was the key to Nevada? The key to Nevada was they only had one congressman. That was the whole key. And so the state that got the nuclear queen of spades got it not on the basis of sound environmental and scientific evaluation of what was the best place to put all the nuclear waste for eternity, essentially, but it was based on which state had the smallest number of members of the House of Representatives. Okay? And so, as you can imagine, over the last 20 years or so now, there has been the manifestation of any number of very serious questions about Yucca Mountain. The area is seismically active. They can't meet the million-year protective standard called for by the National Academy of Sciences. There's been a scandal over falsified seismic data. The nuclear industry, of course, responds by trying to telescope the time frame that it would take in order to plant it inside of that particular location. But it just can't work. As George Gershwin might say, the Rockies may crumble, Yucca may tumble, they're only made of clay, but plutonium is here to stay. And that's essentially the standard, you know, the Gershwin standard has to be met. Next you have the nuclear proliferation problem. The nuclear proliferation problem is one where the United States, as we know, preaches temperance from a bar stool. We want to tell the rest of the world that they should not, in fact, be interested in nuclear weapons, even as we're touting, that is the Bush administration, and pretty much all previous administrations, the qualities of nuclear power. We've already seen, just in the very recent period of time, that President Chavez of Venezuela now said he's interested in having a nuclear power plant, which I think is just really a wonderful tribute to how even in that kind of a oil and gas overflowing economy, that nuclear power can be very attractive. In India, the Indians have now persuaded President Bush to waive the Non-Proliferation Act and the Nuclear Suppliers Group requirements for India in order to have the United States provide nuclear materials to the Indian government. Now, that's just really a wonderful tribute to the president's commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that he's going to tell the other 150 nations in the world, which are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that while they've been good countries and abiding by them, that he's going to provide nuclear materials to a country that has not, even though that country is known to have used its civilian nuclear plant as a cover for its nuclear weapons program. Now, we can go through Pakistan, North Korea, Iran. Every one of them used their civilian nuclear power program as the cover for their nuclear weapons program. And by the way, the president in the energy bill that passed and was signed in August over my amendment, which was rejected, has now committed to the reprocessing of nuclear weapons-grade material. And that's the first time since Gerald Ford in 1974 that an administration has taken that position, and it is now in the law. Again, not a good signal to be sending to the rest of the world that we will be commencing, once again, the reprocessing of civilian fuel into weapons-grade material. And our moral credibility, our political credibility, of course, depleted as we head down that path. So in the United States and in the West, we largely see nuclear power plants as generators of electricity that have this unfortunate byproduct of nuclear waste. In the hands of the countries that I've just mentioned, they see it as generators of material that can be used in a nuclear weapons program that has a wonderful byproduct of electricity. And so you still don't have a squaring up in our own country of the consequences of heading down that path. Then you have the safety and security issues. A nuclear reactor is just one way of generating heat to boil water, to power a turbine, to generate electricity. It competes with many other ways in which the very same thing can be accomplished. The problem is if there's an accident or a terrorist attack on a natural gas plant, the lights go off, people at the plant are injured and killed, but that's it. If there's an attack or an accident at a nuclear power plant, the consequences are far greater. Hundreds of deaths immediately, tens of thousands of deaths are cancers due to radiation, significant regions of land are closed to human habitation, etc., etc. So experts say an accident can't happen. Obviously, Chernobyl can't happen. Obviously, Three Mile Island can't happen. But once it does happen, then there is obviously a serious problem for that industry, which hits. You have, in this new era, also the threat of deliberate terrorist attacks. We know from documents that have been captured from Al-Qaeda that nuclear power plants are at the very top of the terrorist target list here in the United States and around the globe. And we also know that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has yet to, in fact, propound a new permanent rulemaking on security around nuclear power plants for the design basis threat for nuclear power. And that's because the nuclear industry still basically sees the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as its wholly owned subsidiary. They don't really want to highlight the extent to which nuclear power plants are high on the Al-Qaeda terrorist target list. And because of that, we have an incredible contrast between what happened on 9/11. 19 terrorists, highly sophisticated, highly educated, suicidal, and the amount of security which is required around nuclear power plants. You basically have to plan for what happened on 9/11. And thus far, the NRC has yet to put in place that permanent new rulemaking. That's just another cost which the industry is unwilling to bear. So the issue of the security of transportation of radioactive materials, taking steps to address the dirty bomb threat by increasing security and reducing the radioactive sources whenever possible, and recovering old sources, requiring the NRC to consult with the Department of Homeland Security on risk associated with potential new reactors, sites, or designs. Of course, all of this resisted by the Bush administration. Then you have the market problem. As we all know, there has not been a new nuclear power plant ordered in the United States since 1973 or 1974. A lot of that is because Republican investment bankers no longer see nuclear power as a place where they can effectively and successfully invest. And that being the case, they have moved over towards natural gas significantly over the last 10 or 15 years. And in this bill, by the way, inside of this new energy bill, which was just signed, no governor or mayor has any power to block the siting of an LNG facility anywhere along the coastline of the United States. So the new plan is to have this importation of LNG along both coasts of our country in massive quantity. In other words, natural gas is now going to become more like oil in terms of there being a global marketplace for natural gas. So that being the case, it is going to be very difficult over time for the nuclear industry to successfully compete against these other energy sources. Unless inside of the new energy bill, massive new subsidies for the nuclear industry are built. And so over my serial amendments, all of these nuclear activities have now been given huge new subsidies. And so what we're now hearing is that Duke Power, Mississippi Power and Light may consider, because of these huge new subsidies, building new nuclear power plants in our country. And that's fine and dandy for the first two or three nuclear power plants. But you cannot have a system that operates in defiance of the laws of economics for a sustained period of time. Largely, what happened the first time to nuclear power was the consumers just revolted against the incredibly high price of electricity from generation of nuclear power plants. Just killed it. What they're trying to do now is immunize the first two or three or four plants from that by having massive federal subsidies, which I suppose at a certain level you can do anything if you are willing to pay the price to sustain a non-economic model. But over time, the taxpayers will revolt if that is the only system which is in place, knowing that these other more competitive domestic energy sources or imported energy sources are there, natural gas principally, as a means of generating electricity. So that's a serious problem. Inside of this energy bill, there are so many nuclear subsidies that Adam Smith is spinning in his grave so fast that he would qualify for a subsidy under the bill as a new source of electrical generating capacity, okay? It's just absolutely absurd. And it just is non-sustainable, all right, over time, because the taxpayer and consumer will just revolt. That's just realistic. And I actually believe CEOs will lose their jobs because here you'll have other CEOs saying, you know what I'm doing? I'm going to build a new gas-fired facility, you know, really close to where these LNG facilities are, and I'm going to have the thing up in line in 3 years, and there's going to be some other clown who is going back down this line of thinking that's 1950s and 60s thinking, which makes sense when you think about this administration, okay? Because, you know, when I was a kid, my favorite program was Rocky and Bullwinkle, and I love Rocky and Bullwinkle, and it was on, you know, Saturday afternoon around 5 o'clock, right before Bowling for Dollars. And what used to happen is they had this little segment of fractured history where this dog scientist, Mr. Peabody, used to take this little boy, Sherman, into the Wayback Machine and study fractured history. And I used to love it. But you know what? George Bush is born in the same month I am, July 1946. And I think he actually took this show literally. Okay? There's the whole idea of a Wayback Machine. And so here you have this whole notion that somehow or other it will be possible to subsidize this nuclear industry into a marketplace competitive posture. Okay? When we know it is impossible. It just can't work. Okay? Not going to work. But this bill reflects that kind of desire to have their will supplant marketplace forces. And so I wind up, which I have for the last, I've been on the Energy Committee for 30 years. This is my 30th year. And I've been on the Natural Resources Committee for 30 years. So those two committees, 60 years I have been on the two committees. 60 years of hearings. Okay? We come back to these moments where the Republicans harness voluminous amounts of information to defend knowingly erroneous premises. And the erroneous premise is that somehow or other, with just a little bit of a tweak, you can make the nuclear power industry come back to life again. So what do we need to do then? What we need to do is to have a realistic strategy that looks at the things which can be done. Inside of this bill, the president opposes the Markey-Bolitt Amendment, which would have increased by 10 miles per gallon the fuel economy standards for SUVs and automobiles to reduce greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Just totally flat out oppose them. That is, almost every single significant nuclear power proponent inside of Congress opposes simultaneously. And these are the industries that propose nuclear power as the answer to greenhouse gases, oppose increasing fuel economy standards. And I know because it's my amendment, and it has been my amendment on the House floor every year for the last 5 years. In 1986, when I was the chairman of Energy, I put on the books for the first time the law that that creates national appliance efficiency standards. So all these appliance efficiency standards that you see that are propounded all go back to my 1986 law when I was chairman. Again, the principal proponents of nuclear power as the answer to greenhouse gases don't seem to be bothered by the fact that over the last 5 years, the Bush administration has not, in fact, propounded one new energy efficiency standard out of the Department of Energy that would deal with the relationship between those appliances and the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, while simultaneously, of course, proposing that nuclear power is the answer. And so, since we all know in this room that electrical generation is nothing more than the collective demand of every light bulb and refrigerator and stove and heating and cooling device in the United States, and if we didn't have these devices, we wouldn't need electricity, wouldn't it make sense, since we just don't have as much oil and natural gas as we would like here in the United States, to be a world giant in energy efficiency and making all these devices 2 and 3 and 4 times more energy efficient than they had been back during the period of time that Mr. Peabody and Sherman were walking our Earth for the first time before reruns. But no, they don't think this way. They think that you can ignore energy efficiency. That is what we are the giant in, what makes us great, and somehow or other offer up one of these magic asterisk silver bullet answers through nuclear power, which just can't work in the marketplace. And so you wind up and have all these other collateral problems, which would wind up with the United States having aircraft carriers floating off of Pakistan and India and Iran and Iraq and Venezuela and all around the world. Okay, North Korea is intractable. That's another one of these deals where you promise a nuclear power plant. We promise to give you a nuclear power plant if you promise us not to use it for a nuclear bomb, and then we give the plant to a sociopath in North Korea. Okay, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Okay, the whole policy is absurd. Same thing is true in Iran or China. You know, the United States government is now talking about using the Export-Import Bank to finance the sale of 6 nuclear power plants to China. Like, we should be, as taxpayers of the United States, should be subsidizing the sale of nuclear power plants with all these unresolved issues about China's cooperation with countries in the Middle East that were pursuing and are still pursuing nuclear weapons. So this duality, this pretend, allows the Bush administration to ignore the fact that we only have 2.5% of the oil reserves in the world, that time is running out on us, that we consume 25% of the oil in the world, and that we should be looking over here at at a real strategy that gives us a chance to make a transition to a new world of renewables, of solar, of wind, of biomass, that will signal the demise of the fossil fuel era, the greenhouse gas era. But instead of having a national address in prime time to tell the American people that's where we should be going, you have essentially an anti-technology administration. You have an administration that doesn't believe in stem cell research, is not going to give an increase to the NIH budget, has their experts analyzing Terry Schiavo's medical status on television and making the wrong diagnosis, has a Republican Congress which had as its first act the abolition of the Office of Technology Assessment in Congress. Huh? Remember that? Remember these golden oldies? Huh? Well, they still live. Their legacy still lives in the Congress. And then their answer is a 1950s and 60s energy policy. Huh? So a better strategy, a smarter strategy, you know, the strategy of the people who are in this room, whose writings, you know, are the principal influence on me and my attitude from a public policy perspective in making all of these amendments in these two committees, is to move to a 21st century strategy, which they, of course, are not going to do. And so rather than buying into a non-starter of an energy policy, a nuclear strategy, because of its Wall Street implications here domestically and environmental issues, and because of its nuclear non-proliferation implications internationally, we should be the world leader. We only spend $90 million a year on photovoltaics. Europe is up to $300 to $400 million. China now has 20 million homes that have their water heated by photovoltaics. We're going to wind up buying the solar technologies from other countries. Rather than heading in a direction that would give us our answer, using our real assets, the president refuses to do so. So I thank Helen for giving me the opportunity to be here with you today with the litany of saints, which I see sitting out in front of me. You're all the principal influences on my attitudes on these issues. Thank you all so much for having me here.
That was Representative Ed Markey from Massachusetts. He spoke in November 2005 at a conference near Washington, D.C., organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott. You heard the first part in a mini-series on the urgent question, are nuclear power plants coming back to the USA? Thanks to the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, Helen Caldicott's organization, for making the recordings available. Visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. That's nuclearpolicy.org. Come back for the second part of this series when TUC Radio returns. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.